Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, your host. My guest this morning is James Randi, president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, and our topic is pseudoscience. James, glad to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
This show, as I explained to you earlier, is part of a larger series on science and technology. And I know that you're especially concerned about the ways in which the public has abandoned science and embraced what you call pseudoscience.
Very much.
What do you mean by pseudoscience?
Well, science that has the trappings of science, white coats, test tubes, labs, PhDs, people who should know better but apparently don't. If it has the trappings, the appearance of genuine science, then the public is deceived into believing that it is real science. And a lot of pseudoscience is done by real scientists who have already established records in the academic field and in their particular specialty, but that doesn't stop them from becoming silly eventually and turning into scientists. It happens all the time.
Okay, could you give some examples? What do you mean by pseudoscience, specifically?
Well, science, again, that has the trappings and the words and the references and the general language, the general setup, and looks like science, but is not actually science. Now, science, simply defined, is a search for knowledge of the world around us. And it has certain rules that the scientists have agreed to go along with. That is that the evidence suggests a conclusion, but not that the desired for a conclusion suggests the evidence. You don't look into your evidence to find proof of what you would like to be true. You have to examine the evidence and come to the conclusion to which it leads you, and then set up a test for the conclusion that you've arrived at. And they must be the claim, the theory that you develop, or the knowledge or the picture of the world that you develop as a result of your experimentation must be testable. It must be falsifiable. There must be some way to show that it might be wrong. If I say that there's a blue dinosaur in this room, that's my theory, and I've got lots of evidence, anecdotal stories and whatnot to provide evidence of it, but it's an invisible dinosaur, you say, well, I can pass my arms around the room. Dinosaurs are pretty large. No, this is a very, very small dinosaur. I see. Well, I can't see it. No, it's an invisible dinosaur. If you keep on making up rules along the way that make it impossible for your theory to be tested, then you haven't got a conclusion. You haven't performed science that can be checked on. You may be right, but that doesn't mean that we have to accept it. We only accept scientific conclusions that can be tested and can be established.
All right, what are some of the primary examples of pseudoscience that bother you the most?
Oh, it happens in medicine all the time. We have medical claims being made. You see commercials on television, sometimes a half hour or even an hour in length, the infomercials, which keep on saying clinically tested. But if we don't know anything about that clinic, that may be some fellow just over the border in Mexico who works out of his bathroom. We don't know. Unless we know something about the clinic and the authorities who tested it and what their test consists of, we don't know much about it. So the words clinically established or clinically tested or clinically approved don't mean anything unless you can discover something about the qualifications of these people, because I can set myself up as being a clinic just by registering as a clinic, and that doesn't mean I have to have any equipment or knowledge about the subject. So that's the kind of thing that is being gotten away with increasingly, and the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is not very alert to this sort of thing, or if they are, they don't do anything about it, or perhaps they can't do anything about it. Homeopathy, for example, is sheer quackery. It's witchcraft. It's a pleasant notion, but it has been tested endlessly, and in double-blind tests, it fails. Now, that's not made evident to the public. When they go into Eckerd Drugs, for example, or any large drug chain, they all carry homeopathic remedies. Now, it often says on the label, this is not intended to treat or cure any disease. But people don't get to read the small print on the labels and on the packages. They should be reading those things, and they should be made aware of it. It shouldn't be tiny print that's almost impossible to read. It should be evident right there that this is not supposed to cure anything. It's what we call homeopathic medicine. And in my estimation, it's worthless.
Okay. Are there other examples?
For example, Sandia Labs recently And they're in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Very reputable lab run by very reputable people and supported by the Department of Energy and such. And they've always done an excellent job so far as I know. And I rather well know some people there, and I was just with them a few days ago. Now, they were asked by the Department of Energy to test a thing called the DKL locator. This is a spurious device, which is simply a dowsing rod with no connections to the electronics that are on the inside, and the electronics aren't even powered, so they're just sitting there like a chip off a computer, but not connected to anything. And yet this thing is being sold for tens of thousands of dollars to federal agencies around this country to locate aliens in trucks, Mexicans coming across the border, you can read for that if you will, and drugs in suitcases, and it doesn't work. Now, we've offered our $1 million prize here at the James Randi Educational Foundation to the DKL people, if they will give us a demonstration of this and show that it works. Sandy Labs tested it, and it failed miserably. But now DKL is saying they didn't know how to test it, even though the president and vice president of the DKL company were there, and they were the people operating this this spurious device. It's simply a dowsing stick, and they don't seem to realize that, or if they realize it, they won't admit it. And yet our federal agencies are paying fortunes for this. The Border Patrol, Customs Service, all sorts of agencies. And that's our tax money going down the drain. But the FTC can't do anything about it. It takes them 3 to 4 years to catch up with these people. It only took me 25 minutes. I think I could teach them a lesson.
Okay. I know there are other examples, and maybe they're sort of on the borders of pseudoscience that that you've mentioned in some of your works. The number of police, for example, that will turn to a so-called psychic to help them find a criminal or find a lost child. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are things which at least have the trappings of science in that police officials, government officials will rely upon them.
Well, now, that's an iffy question, however, an iffy subject. Most has the idea that the police regularly go to psychics for this kind of help. That's not true. You picture yourself as a detective department now, and you know that your obligation is to listen to everybody who says they know something about a crime. You have to. It's your franchise. That's what you're paid to do. So if a murder takes place in the locality or any place, and some person comes up to the detective office and says, I know something about that murder, they have to sit them down and listen to them. And they can fill tape recordings, 90-minute tape recordings, two or three of them on both sides, and get nothing but things like the letter R, and there's the color red. So red has something to do with this, and I'm getting moisture of some kind. It may be flowing water, or it may be rain, and I smell oil as well, and it goes on and on and on and on like this. They have to record that. They have to listen to it. And the so-called psychic walks out of the detective department, goes to the press and says, I was just consulted by the detectives down at the local station on this murder. And that's the way it gets published in the paper. Not the fact that the police were forced to listen to this because this person just might know something. Not necessarily through psychic means, but because they might have been connected or they might have some sort of clue or impression of something that might have happened and they have to be interviewed. Now that is the truth in a good 95% of the cases. In some cases, police departments have been unwisely known to call in psychics, and the psychics never give them any help whatsoever. Extensive research was done on that several years ago at the Los Angeles Police Department, and they found only two things: that the psychics were no good to the police, and all they did, the second thing, was they slowed down the investigation by having them dig up city dumps and swamps and whatnot and find nothing.
So there are two problems with these kind of cases. One is that the public has a false perception of the actual use of psychics by police. And secondly, even the cases where they might have been consulted by the police, the results are of to no avail.
Yes, and not only that, but the public gets the impression through the media that the police are always going to psychics and that the psychics are helpful. Now, Dorothy Allison years ago lives in Nutley, New Jersey. She was called in on the Atlanta murders that were performed down there and these young black boys. And she was called in on that, and they had great publicity when she went down. They sent camera crews along with her on the plane that was specially chartered to go down there, and they followed her all over the streets and whatnot, and with the police department, and she told them something like, oh, I've forgotten, 104 or 5 names like that, that she said were connected with it. None of those names were Wayne, none of them were Williams, and Wayne Williams turned out to be the man who had committed the murders, and who was tried and convicted on that on very, very good evidence. There's no doubt of it whatsoever. And yet she never mentioned a name that sounded like Bill, even, which might relate to Williams. So she was no use whatsoever, but the press never followed up on that. I never saw anything on the news, and I've looked up every source I can saying that she was wrong. But when she appears to be right, and when she first goes down there, the press is right on her, and they give her photographs, long television interviews, whole special programs on her. She's interviewed on everything from Oprah through Larry King, and they make a big deal of it. But when she fails, they mention nothing, because the press considers that to be a non-story. And it's not a non-story. It's part of the story, and the public has the right to know that.
Okay, so in general, there really are two different issues. One concerns the extent to which people in power do believe or buy claims of pseudoscientists. The second concerns a way in which the media initially reports their involvement and fails to report their failures.
That's right. The media filters the thing out very carefully. Another example of that very filtration is such things as the A&E Network some time ago did an interview with me on a biography program they were doing on Nostradamus. Now, that program lasted a whole hour. I was used for about 95 seconds in the whole thing, though they interviewed me for over 4 hours here in Florida at my foundation office. They interviewed me for all that time trying to get answers they could use, but they couldn't use any of the answers. And the only time I appeared on the screen with a subtitle underneath me saying, James Randi, author of The Mask of Nostradamus, the only time they used me was for biographical details, which they could have gotten from any dictionary or encyclopedia. They didn't use one of the things I said about the quatrains that were handled in the rest of the program, showing that these were totally erroneous interpretations.
Maybe then there are two different questions, related questions here about why individuals are inclined to believe pseudoscientific claims and why and what role the media plays in perpetrating beliefs mm-hmm. in pseudoscience. What would you have to say about both of those?
Well, the reason why people believe is they're looking for some magic. They're looking for some easy solution. They don't want to have to go through the thinking process. They don't want to have to go through the work. They want it all done for them. They want something simple, something they can understand. Now, we know very well that quantum physics is very, very difficult for the layman to understand, difficult for most scientists to understand. But that doesn't mean that it's magic. It doesn't mean that you can't understand it. It means sometimes you've got to put some effort into understanding these things. Otherwise, you can't just go to magic, go to some easy solution. I want to know about the future. Well, I can study the stock market. No, I can go to a psychic, and the psychic will tell me how to invest. Really? On the 1-900 psychic hotline, for example? Isn't it amazing that that particular service on television and via telephone that gave advice to tens of thousands of people every day around this country had 2,400 psychics working for it, and yet none of them saw that they were going to go bankrupt the following week. Not one of them. It seems to me that's a big advisory panel you've got there, and if the psychics can't figure out that they're going to go out of business next Monday, there's something wrong with their divinative powers, I would say.
Now, could you say a little bit more, too, about the media's role in all this? Do the people in the media believe the claims of psychics, the claims of pseudoscientists themselves?
Hard to say. Some of them do, some of them don't. I don't think, for example, that Larry King believes for 1 minute that the psychics he has on there are genuine psychics, but he knows what makes a good program. I don't think the media in general are terribly interested in whether or not the thing is true. They're more interested in whether or not it's attractive and if it appeals to the public. Now, I figure that's really a miserable way to look at life, in my estimation, and look at your profession. I think there's no integrity there whatsoever, if that's the case. Now, many of the media, we've got lots of friends in the media who will not promote these things because they know better, and they call us here at the JREF to ask us advice on the thing and ask us if we have information. We gladly share that with them immediately. But how many of them call us, we send them information, and they never use it? I've had major television programs that I can name for, I mean major ones, such as 2020, for example, who some years ago did a thing on psychic surgery. They spent over an hour with me on the telephone getting information. I sent them faxes, I sent them photocopies, every piece of information I had, and yet they never used any of it. And the program they did was very supportive of this so-called psychic surgery that's done in the Philippines. It's all sleight of hand. It has never saved anybody's life. They don't perform real operations. It's total trickery. And yet, the 2020 program saw, I guess the editor said, well, that's not the attitude we want. We want to be politically correct, so we'll accept everything these people say. And I'm sure that as a result, people went to the Philippines to be operated on and came back here to die. This it borders on the criminal, in my estimation.
Okay, when you say, for example, about psychic surgery, that it just doesn't work, I mean, what specifically do you mean? I mean, is it something that any good conjurer can do?
Yes, absolutely. I've taught 12-year-old kids to do this on television programs very easily. It's not a difficult sleight of hand thing at all. I do it practically every one of my lectures, or use a tape of me doing it on some show or other, just to show people how easily done it is. And yet it's very effective when you're on that table and you think you've got a fatal disease of some kind, and they say that they're taking tumors out. Now, the only time I ever spoke to Peter Sellers was in Pinewood Studios in England many years ago, and he said to me that he believed in psychic surgery because both of his astrologers had told him that this was the real thing, this is what the stars said he should do. So twice a year he went off to the Philippines to have his heart operated on. Now, his doctors had told him he needed bypass surgery. He needed a triple bypass, and he was very ill. He could hardly take his breath. He was working on a movie that was never finished, and he died in the middle of the production. But he told me, he said, Mr. Randy, I saw this with my own eyes. And I said to him, Peter, tell me, with who else's eyes might you have seen it? Well, the conversation broke up at that point, unfortunately, and Sellers, a couple of months later, went back to the Philippines, came back to work on the movie, and died on the set of heart failure. Now, we lost Peter Sellers, and we've lost a lot of other valuable people simply because they think they're smarter than some charlatans out in the Philippines or any place in the world who have the wool pulled over their collective eyes.
Let's turn to a slightly different case, which comes up, and again, it sort of borders on the pseudoscience as you defined it, because perhaps there are not lots of scientists who study it, but there certainly are very smart people who believe in alien abductions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say to someone who says, I was abducted by an alien?
Well, you said smart. I differ with you on that. They might be intelligent, they might be well-educated, they may be very perceptive, have high IQs, all of those things. That doesn't make them smart. Smart is the ability to handle the real world as it occurs. As smart is being able to find a can of peas after the atom bomb hits. Smart is being able to survive in the street and manage your real life in a real world. Intelligence and education has very little to do with that when you come right down to nitty-gritty and actually handling the real world. Now, this whole alien abduction thing of being taken off to Venus and Mars always strikes me rather funny. Nobody of any importance ever gets picked up. It's always some bored housewife or a drunken fisherman or some such thing. They get taken off to Mars, and of course they have their genital areas examined with great glee by the aliens. I have no idea why aliens are so interested in the reproductive systems of human beings. But these people just love to come back and tell Oprah about it and Larry King. They just delight in doing that because it gets them on TV. It gives them a profile they would never have otherwise. It lasts for about 2 weeks, and then that's the end of it. Now, if these people are going to come from other star systems and they're going to contact civilization here, I would think they might do it on a higher level, land on the White House lawn or some such thing. I think they could get away with that pretty well, and that Bill Clinton would probably walk out and say hello because he'd see a good photo opportunity there. Why is it that they're always very unimportant, insignificant people who are bored with life and want some attention who get visited by the aliens and get taken off to Venus and Mars? And not only that, when they come back from Venus, they say, oh, it's a very nice place, gardens all over. We know it is not a nice place. We know that through science. We've observed it in close-up. We know that it's not the way they describe it to be. But since we can't go there on regular tours that are arranged through the local travel agents, they get away with this because most people are not that well informed about it.
Are these people lying when they say they were abducted?
I don't think they're lying in some cases, because there's such a thing as what we call the hypnopompic and hypnagogic experiences, and I'll send you to an encyclopedia to look those up. They're pretty lengthy to describe, but these are hallucinations that we can often have when we're going to bed and falling to sleep, or just before we wake up in the morning, or in the middle of the night, as a matter of fact. And some people think these things are so strong that they couldn't possibly be hallucinations. Now, I talked to a chap not too long ago from Phoenix, Arizona, who said, but Mr. Randy, this is real. It wasn't an hallucination. I said, what's the definition of an hallucination? He said, I've got it right here. And he read it out of his dictionary. I had forgotten what dictionary it was, but it said something to the effect, a sensory impression that is so strong that it does not appear to be unreal. And I said, well, isn't that right there? He said, but I know it wasn't an hallucination because it happened to me. Now, an hallucination is something that you don't know is not real, but is not real. It's a misrepresentation of your sensory system. You've been betrayed by your sensory system, if we can put it that way. So these people often do believe what they say at first, but then their story starts to grow, and by the time they got on Oprah with it, they weren't only taken to Venus, they were taken to most of the stars, too, and they've got a full description of the clothing that the aliens wore and with their names and their families and the whole thing.
Okay, let's turn in the last part of the show to talk about the remedy. And in a way, an earlier answer points us in the right direction. You made a distinction between being smart, being intelligent, and being educated. So what you've got in mind, I take it, is education of some form. I mean, that's in the title of your organization.
Right.
But that you think there's something fundamentally flawed with the education that we now have.
Absolutely. At the James Randi Educational Foundation, we bring in classrooms and we send instructors, such as my colleague Andrew Harder, who is very good at this. He goes out to classrooms and actually partakes in the educational process. And teachers who experience this, they just come to us with tears in their eyes and say, this is what I've been looking for. Because the average teacher doesn't know what UFOs really are. They don't know anything about therapeutic touch or chiropractic or any of these things. They just know the name, and they see the signs, and they see the articles in trashy newspapers and whatnot. They see these things, they get a peripheral idea of it, and when their students ask them about it, they don't know what to say. Now, under a substantial grant that we're applying for at this moment, we hope to turn out 20-minute videotapes that will be distributed free of charge to teachers anywhere in the country, in fact, around the world eventually, we hope, that will inform them about these things. A dispassionate and very well-centered, I would hope, discussion of such off-the-wall subjects that teachers are often asked about by their students. But the average teacher is certainly not equipped to answer these questions, and to merely brush it off and say, oh, no, that's all nonsense, I don't want to talk about that, is not satisfactory to a student. Students want to know, and they should be told. We quote Bertrand Russell very often here. What is needed is not the will to believe, but the will to find out. And critical thinking is the way to find out. That's what we want to teach, and that's what we want to instill into teachers. Critical thinking is important. Now, sometimes that runs into your personal philosophy. Many parents come to us and say, but they won't ask about God, will they? I don't know. And if they ask about God, I'll give my opinion, and Andrew will as well. We will all here at the JREF give our honest opinion and ask them, if they want to share it with us, fine. If they don't want to, that's fine too, because everyone has the freedom to make these choices. That's what the U.S. of A. is all about, and we must never lose track of that. Not only that, but I must add this, it doesn't mean that people who believe in UFOs and in therapeutic touch and homeopathy and ESP and people flying by flapping their arms, it doesn't mean they're stupid. It just means, in most cases, that they're uninformed. You know, the harsher word is ignorant. But there's nothing wrong with being ignorant unless you can repair it. And the means are out there. You can repair it. Courses are offered, in many cases, free of charge. And certainly here at the Foundation, we want to teach you critical thinking. It's a very good thing to have. Skepticism is not a bad word. It's a good word. And when people kick the tires on cars, they don't realize it, but they're being skeptical and they're employing critical thinking.
Okay, explain more. How would you describe this difference between education as it's normally done and critical thinking skills?
Unfortunately, I think in this country, I think this is the most important thing, our teachers are not well enough paid. Teachers should be paid as very highly respected professionals, but at the same time, they have to be able to produce. They have to be able to be teachers, not just instructors who say, read chapter 4 and we'll talk about it tomorrow. That's not teaching. Teaching is getting kids interested, getting the students in general, whether they're kids or adults, interested in looking into these things, inspiring them, showing them that knowing about things is very exciting. It's not dull. It's not a set of rules. It's a set of guidelines that will enable you to find out about the real world, and that's what science is really all about. That's inspired teaching. I don't find much of that, frankly. We have teachers here in Florida that have blown me away by being such great teachers. They are really exceptional, and we've got a couple in local schools right near us here, and they come to us and just wring their hands in despair and say, but I'm surrounded by people who don't know how to teach. And that's quite true in our educational system. I don't find it to be the same way in Europe. And that's one of our shames, I think, here. Here we are, one of the most advanced civilizations that's ever been on this earth, and we have failed our students by not having a better educational system that is fearless, that does look into every question, regardless of whether it offends somebody's political correctness or not. We must learn to do this, to be brave and to be critical.
So part of what would designate critical thinking skills are, to use two words you've used so far, is one, to be fearless, that is to be willing to look at anything and everything, and secondly, to be skeptical.
Yes.
Could you say a little bit more, too, about what you mean by skeptical?
Yeah, it seems like a dirty word, doesn't it? That's one of those skeptical people over there. But it's really a very healthy attitude. If something doesn't appear to appeal to your sense of reason, and hey, quantum physics doesn't appeal to my sense of reason, but then I look at the people behind it, and I look at the history of it, and as I look into it, I find, by golly, that does make sense. It really does add up, and they can prove it by means of experimentation. So I have to accept it, even though it's not something that I would instinctively accept. There are a lot of things that you don't instinctively accept that are actually true, but most of them, when your instinct says, hey, I smell a rat here, you're probably right, because that's a survival technique that we've all developed over the years and that's hardwired into us the day that we're born. That's very useful to us. So when something seems too good to be true, it's an old saying, I know, old, hackneyed, and worn out, but it's true. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Be suspicious of these things. Don't buy everything that comes along. You see advertisements for magnetic insoles with little magnets embedded in them. It says that there's iron in your blood, hemoglobin in your blood. Yeah, and that helps the blood flow around your body. Nonsense. It does not. It is ineffective. They've been around since the early 1800s, and people who wear them can pick up paper clips on the soles of your shoes, but that's about it, friends. It's no more use to you than that, and they sell for fantastic sums of money. Little bands you put around your wrist and around your neck and you put on your chest and whatnot. These are refrigerator magnets. The refrigerator isn't any better for having the magnets on it, and you won't be either. But if you were critical about these things, you would look at these commercials and you would see them for exactly what they are. It appears that the government, the federal government through the FTC, is not going to protect us on these things until it's too late. But we have to protect ourselves. We have to know about it because those government agencies have failed us.
I hate to say it, we are out of time. Thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
It's been a pleasure, and invite me back if you can stand it.
I'm sure I can at some point in the future. Thank you very much for appearing today. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. My guest today has been James Randi, president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Good day.